Welcome to Local Talk on KHUI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Kay Potter, your host today. Thank you for joining me to listen in. The weather now is making us all feel that summer is really here, and this past weekend in Ames there were plenty of opportunities to enjoy the weather, with the art walk downtown on Friday evening and Summerfest in Campus Town on Saturday. And this year there was something absolutely new to Ames at both these street festivals, and we'll be hearing about that in just a minute. Something else that happens in the summer is new construction, and we're certainly seeing a lot of that in Ames right now. Coming up in about 10 minutes, we'll be hearing about city planning from Kelly Diekman, the Director of Planning and Housing for the City of Ames. Mr. Diekman will be sharing with us some of the reasons why we need all this new construction. And then, for a completely different perspective on the housing market, we'll be hearing from someone who's been in the business of renting out property, mostly to students, for 45 years. But first of all, let's hear just a taste of something that you might have heard downtown on Friday evening at the Art Walk. People playing and improvising outside on a public piano in Tom Evans Plaza. From now on, you should be able to hear music like that and all sorts of different music. At least when it's not raining, you should be able to hear that all summer. There are now two brightly painted outdoor pianos in Ames, one at Tom Evans Plaza on Main Street and one at Campus Town Court, the little seating and picnic area near the clock tower on Welch Avenue. These pianos were installed just in time for the activities this last weekend, and they'll be there until the fall, available for anyone who wants to play on them. I spoke with Patricia Izbicki, the person responsible for the installation of these public pianos. Patricia is a graduate student at Iowa State, and she's been working on this outdoor piano project for a year now. Welcome, Patricia.
Thank you very much for having me.
First of all, tell us about the installation of these pianos. I believe you're the spearhead, as it were, of the group that got this and got all the requisite permissions and so on. Tell us about that process and then about the installation of the pianos.
Essentially, this process has taken a little bit over a year. And what first happened is I found two donors for the pianos, and one piano was painted by the Neuroscience of Music course I taught there. These were very, very bright and talented kids from middle school, and we decided to do this project in my course. And then the other piano was painted by also the fabulously brilliant and talented campers from the First Baptist Church of Ames Music Camp. And this was last year, and so it's taken about a good few months to get all of the necessary permissions from the city and from the various art councils. And these are specifically Ames Parks and Recreation, which they've been wonderful in helping me work with the project, as well as the Main Street Cultural District and the Ames Public Arts Commission. And so after communicating with everyone there, and we finally got everything ready to go around April. And
you mentioned students in neuroscience and music, and that reminded me, you are a graduate student in neuroscience at ISU, right?
Yes, so I'm going into my third year in the department there, and I actually study how music affects the brain with Dr. Elizabeth Stugemuller, who's a music therapist and neuroscientist, so we've actually, our interests align, and that's why I have this interest in promoting music in the community, because there's so many beneficial effects of music on the brain, obviously.
Right. Well, that's a fascinating topic in itself, which I'd certainly like to go into in more detail another time. In fact, I was just hearing today people are becoming deaf and having trouble listening to conversations in crowded restaurants, for example, that if they sing, and there's something about music and singing that helps them to listen more selectively and hear better if they're deaf. I just heard that today.
And there's definitely an advantage if you've been formally trained in music, you're better able to hear, you know, different sounds such as a conversation in a room full of noise.
Even when you're going deaf. Okay, so the students that helped you paint the pianos, how old were they?
The first group, so this was from the Neuroscience of Music course, they were from grades 5 through 8, so essentially the middle school age. And then from the second group, from the First Baptist Church of Ames Music Camp, they range, oh my goodness, all the way from kindergarten through 6th grade.
And presumably the special paint, since these pianos are going to sit outside.
Yes, yes, yes. We started off first with waterproof primer, waterproof paint, then did several layers of varnish that's waterproof, that essentially goes on furniture that's supposed to be sitting outside for long periods of time. And then after that, I was really fortunate that Tom Russell and Will Pett, there are two wonderful piano technicians here in Ames.
Yes, in fact, Tom has a show on KHY,
he
All
does.
Things Piano.
He does. So he's, him and Will have just been wonderful in helping me weatherproof the piano further inside so that the soundboard doesn't get wet, and other things. They've helped tune so much. They've helped repair the pianos because the pianos were a little bit used, so they weren't in, they aren't going to be in tip-top condition like a concert piano, right?
Right.
I mean, they are supposed to be outside. But
are they grand pianos or baby grands
pianos? One is, the one in Campus Town will be an upright, and then the one in Main Street will be a spinet, so it's almost like, I always think of it as a smaller version of the upright piano.
Okay. When the kids were painting, we'll get to see these pianos soon, but are they just covered with a flat color, or are the designs painted on it, or what?
Oh, they are as colorful and so many designs. They each had essentially their own spot or square of the piano that they picked out, but essentially were assigned, and they could have any creative liberties they chose on that one spot. And so it not only does, I mean, the pianos just have this energy and brightness to them that, I mean, if you don't smile, I don't know what else will make you smile with that. But also learning how to work together and climbing over each other and asking nicely if someone needs to move. So it was a good experience for the kids as well as the creative component.
Sure. So this will be part of the experience too, just looking at these pianos.
Yes, 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 definitely.
Then Patricia went on to describe the different kinds of musicians that would be performing, and in fact now have performed, during the mini concerts, during the art walk and the summer fest. And various people performing, including yourself.
Yes, and it'll essentially, all of the musicians and different groups are from the Ames area. So it was really not only to kick off the public piano season, but also to show the different diversity of music, as well as ages of musicians. We will have some very young ones, some actually musicians from young pianists from the Neuroscience of Music course, all the way up to a little bit more professional, so ISU alumni or current students at the ISU Music Department, and then some other local musicians.
But presumably these pianos will continue to be used throughout the summer, right?
Yes, yes. So it is the reason also for the concerts is to show that they are not meant to be there to be looked at. They are to be played and enjoyed as much as possible and interacted with.
Okay, well, this does sound like a lot of fun, but I can't help still worrying about how these pianos stand up to the elements, however carefully they've been painted.
So the first thing that I'll mention is that Ames Parks and Recreation are making sure the pianos are, first of all, installed securely so they don't go rolling down the street, right? And so they've been very good about coordinating that. And so that will be the first kind of almost, you know, safety issue. And then the second one is, how are they actually going to withstand the elements? So first, as I was saying before, the paint is all been waterproof and then coated over with a varnish. So the paint itself shouldn't be able to come off. And then also inside, we've tried to protect the soundboard as much as possible, because if rain gets inside the piano, then that's it. The piano is done. So we've done, or actually Tom and Will have done a really wonderful job trying to secure that as much as possible.
So, you know, with an ordinary upright piano, you can lift you can just lift it up and look inside. You can lift the top of it.
Mm-hmm.
But can you still lift this one up or not? Or has it been sort of secured?
I mean, it's pretty heavy. So I don't think, I mean, it shouldn't be lifted.
Okay.
Lifted up. And in addition to all of that, what's really nice is that local businesses here in Ames, in both in Campus Town and Main Street, have been volunteering to uncover the piano right when they begin business hours, and then end up covering the piano after business
hours. So it has just basically a fitted waterproof cover over it.
It does.
Yes.
In addition to that.
I was imagining a sort of awning or something. So it's just a fitted cover. And if it rains, they'll go out and put it over it, presumably, will they?
Mm-hmm. So that's the hope. And then, we will see how it goes. So, you know.
Since this is the first year that it's happened in Ames, we'll see how it goes.
Right. And these aren't meant to be permanent installations. I mean, rarely are they permanent at anywhere else. I mean, even in Des Moines with the, I believe it's City Sounds, they do the public pianos as well. And they have to disassemble them and take them down every season.
Right. So in the fall, they get taken away.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Unfortunately, they don't last for years. It's just basically through a season. But I'll say from personal experience, I actually got inspired to do this project here in Ames because a professor of mine from my previous institution I was at did this kind of project, and everyone loved it in the city. It really got a great response, and people would be playing on Friday nights, and it's lovely.
It sounds delightful.
Right, yeah. And they've done the same thing in New York, in Denver. Also, I believe in Toronto and other cities all around the world. So people enjoy it, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's just a good way to bring the community together also through sound and through music.
So we can be looking forward to hearing piano music outdoors on Welch and here downtown all summer. A big thank you to Patricia Isbicki and to all the people who helped her with this wonderful project. And now, for a different reason, I'd also like to thank my fellow reporter, Susan Franzen, who provided this next interview with Kelly Diekman, the Director of Planning and Housing for the City of Ames. If you've been looking at all the new apartment buildings going up in Ames and wondering how and why the city decides where to build, you should be interested in this next interview. As it begins, Mr. Diekman is explaining the relationship between new construction and increasing enrollment at the university. But it's not as simple as you might think.
So the City of Ames, so we've been kind of tracking the Iowa State enrollment increase, and we have kind of a reactionary position on that. Iowa State doesn't really have real solid estimates that they provide to us, really don't provide any estimates to us other than some very small estimates they give to the regents. In any one year, it varies greatly from where they say the target estimate might be. So most of our housing market for multifamily apartments is reactionary. And since we've seen the sustained enrollment increase, it's not just because one year we jump in a large number of students, because we've had a 6-year or 7-year run in increased enrollment. It's gotten a lot of attention from national builders as well as local builders and regional builders. So nation looks at us as one of those markets that's very ripe for construction because of Iowa State enrollment. We have a lot of other factors going into that, and it's been a constrained market as well. We haven't produced a lot of housing at times. Right now we are producing quite a bit, but it's kind of come and gone, and there can be long delays when housing isn't built, which kind of creates pent-up demand. So what we've seen in the last 7 years is that we're averaging about 100 single-family homes, maybe 110 single-family homes being built in any one year, and that includes single-family attached and detached homes. But then on the multifamily apartment side, we've been averaging around 300 apartments and almost 1,000 bedrooms total per year. And we've been typically measuring apartment production off of bedrooms rather than units, and that's kind of unique to college towns. nationally, you don't really measure housing production off of bedrooms, but because of the student influence, apartments are constructed differently with more bedrooms than you would normally see in apartments. So when you're a student-designed product, you have more bedrooms, frequently four-bedroom suites instead of ones and twos. You'll build, you know, three, fours, and fives. So we look at the bedroom count more than we look at the units when we're evaluating these projects. So sustained momentum of over 1,000 units, 1,000 bedrooms a year. We're predicting about 1,200 bedrooms coming online again next year. And then there's still capacity for another 1,000 bedrooms the year after that and the year after that. So that's just the projects that we're aware of through 2017 probably.
Well, you have been talking about the housing for students. What about the senior housing? There's quite a few bit of new senior housing being built also.
There is. And so we measure that too. There's really only been three projects that have been senior exclusive. There's two out in Somerset, and there was one on the south end of town that are senior only projects. And that was about 150 senior only apartments that were built in the last 2 years. And we see continued interest in that market as well. As Ames is aging, the baby boomer generation is in that age that everybody's looking at where is their next housing option. And the trend seems to be to see downsizing and to see people relocating to attractive communities like Ames that have a lot of amenities. And so there's a lot of continued interest in the senior side as well. And when we look at the apartments, students get the attention because they're the big number that comes out every year. But what we have found, and the Ames Economic Development Corp Commission wholeheartedly supports this, we don't have enough workforce housing either. And a lot of that's been the product of not having enough student housing, kind of pushing the people that don't have to live in Ames away from Ames, even if their job's here or they may want to be here. They're getting kind of out-competed. So we did a housing occupancy survey. We did a sample survey of vacancy rates in apartments in the fall of 2015. And we had, in that sample, which was mostly the larger apartment complexes, we had less than a 1% vacancy rate. And that is just a big, that's a glaring deficiency in housing capacity. It's not a healthy real estate market for affordability when you have a vacancy rate that's that low. Basically, you have no competition. You have no ability for tenants to kind of have flexibility in what they're looking for and trying to match housing with what they're interested in. So we know that not just because of students, but also because of the workforce needs, we don't have enough housing to meet the demand. The vacancy rate, you would say normally, you would plan for at least a 5% vacancy rate, just as a general rule of thumb for accommodating the general needs of everybody in a community. So we know that there's a need out there still. What we analyzed for the city council recently when we kind of give them annual reports on production, we tried to match up enrollment estimates with production. And as I said, we always have a lag, so we're always about at least a year, maybe 18 months behind in producing the new housing to match the growth. And our conclusion as our department was last year, because we've had a lot of rezonings to allow for more apartments to be built, that we've kind of matched up with the demand from enrollment only with the production, but we're still missing the segment that would be related basically to the economy and to the workforce needs. So that's been our emphasis in the last year, that outside of Campus Town, that the apartments are configured and designed in a manner that's kind of more marketable to a general audience and not just student apartments that are harder for our families or for singles or other people that just live differently or want to live in a smaller unit, that they have choices too. So in the last year, we've negotiated a few different projects into the smaller, more typical apartment type of designs to help give us a wider variety and meet more needs in the city. I can't speak for university housing. So the residence hall program is all managed under the Iowa State umbrella.
Okay.
We don't deal with their permitting. We don't deal with their policies or anything to do with how they market their properties. As a rule, Iowa State doesn't try to accommodate all the enrollment. They've added about 1,500 bedrooms to their capacity in the same time that we've added over 7,000 students. So you can kind of see that they're not trying to match up with exactly what's there for increases. As I understand their policy, they have a general rule that they try to house somewhere between 30 to 35% of their enrollment in on-campus housing, or at least provide that option. And that varies from year to year. And so I really can't speak to how they design or prioritize that housing for different types of tenants or students.
Low-income housing in general is a pretty short supply, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's part of that vacancy rate that I cited to you. When you have a vacancy rate under 1%, the landlords control the market. There's not competition that kind of balances out rent. New housing is not built, and this is pretty common across the country, new housing is not built at low rents. It's built at the high rents, and it kind of feeds then through the system where lower rents are the older buildings and the high rents are always the new buildings. We frequently get inquiries from people that are affordable housing developers that want to take advantage of tax credits from the federal government to try to construct some projects. We have a few of those in town. We haven't had one built since probably about 5 years ago was the last one, and that's Laverne Apartments on South 16th Street. But they have a struggle to find land. We have limited resources. We're very deliberate on what we rezone for apartments. As you've seen them come across the city, a lot of people have negative reactions to change of this type. So it's not like we have a lot of land rezoned for apartments. So it's on a case-by-case basis that we look at these things. And a lot of the affordable housing developers are at a smaller scale. They don't do really large projects, and they really kind of just get out-competed against the market rate stuff. You know, the city has tried to help with affordable housing. We purchased a piece of property on 321 State, and we decided that the need for entry-level ownership housing is where we were going to focus that land resource rather than towards rental needs. But it is a tight market, and it is difficult for affordable housing to get constructed in the city just because of competition. I think, as we've said, we kind of deal with these apartment projects on a case-by-case basis, and the city council has been looking at this continually over the past 3 years. One of the first things that we did 2 years ago when we knew we were going to have a rush of requests was to make an evaluation matrix so that we could kind of rate projects kind of based on their attributes. Are they on bus or transit? Do they have good bus or transit access? Are they integrated with neighborhoods? Are they in natural areas where it would be a natural resource issue to develop that property? And there's kind of a list of features that we look at. So with each one of these projects, we try to rank a project and give that information out as part of the council action form. We like to assess our infrastructure capacity. That's very critical when we're upzoning or changing a zoning to make sure that our water and sewer facilities are there. So although you see a lot of change, we have a pretty rigorous review process to ensure that it can work and that it will work in the city once it's built. So I hope everybody understands that we have a lot of city standards about how these things get done to make sure it works in the long run. And I always say this, that it's really hard to say what your housing needs are going to be, because it's really hard to look out more than 2 years and kind of understand the influences of the economy as well as demographics. The city has an aging demographic, and we also have a younger demographic, which is very similar to the national trends. And when you look at the national trends for development and the national projections for demographics, the kind of the history of a lot of single-family development and not a lot of apartment development isn't really the pattern anymore. There's a strong demand for apartments and multifamily throughout the country that's higher than it was for decades previously. And this is all coming out of the 2008 recession. Kind of the world changed, and you had a younger generation that was looking for more flexibility. You had people that had a lot of housing problems when they lost their houses or affordability issues because of the loans that were given out prior to that. So our market is a lot different, and it's not just influenced by students. It's influenced by a lot of different factors. So I think you will continue to see apartments built in Ames, and it won't be just because of Iowa State enrollment. If Iowa State enrollment starts to flatten out and slow down, you'll still see apartment projects getting built in Ames because of other factors.
Thank you very much.
That was Kelly Diekman, Director of Planning and Housing for the City of Ames. And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Kay Patrick, your host today. And now we'll get a completely different perspective on students and their housing as we listen to this next interview with a local landlord who's been renting out property to students for many years. Susan Franzen and I are pleased to be welcoming Mary Buckman, who's a local landlord, to give us a perspective on what it feels like to be a landlord in a university town. Welcome, Mary. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Would you like to start by telling us how you got into this business?
Well, a long time ago, my late husband and I inherited part of his grandmother's duplex at the time. We took that money and bought another one and another one and another one and ended up with what I have left today.
Which is how
22
many?
22 rental units.
Okay.
Most of them are in central campus, walking distance to campus.
So most of your renters are students?
Yes.
All of them?
I would say 95%, mm-hmm. Yes. I do have a few that graduated, stayed, found a job, still live there.
Okay. So one of the complaints that people that live with a lot of students around, people that have jobs, although here in this town, they're often jobs at Iowa State. They don't like often having students as neighbors. They don't like living in a property with lots of students, rental property with lots of students living in it. But obviously some of your renters don't mind that if they stay.
Yes, I have had one group that's been with me about 4 years now. So I think it's a good mix for everybody. It's diversity in the community. It's a good thing.
Now, how long have you been in this business?
45 years.
A long time.
A long time. So in 1999, my husband got sick and wasn't able to live long enough to fulfill his retirement dreams with this investment in rental properties.
But he made that retirement pretty safe for you.
Yes, he did.
Mm-hmm. So would you like to talk about how your business has evolved over the years and what you've seen develop over the years?
Lots of changes. Lots of federal, state, city requirements as far as housing is concerned. Lots of safety issues. Lots of details that have to be addressed almost on a daily basis sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the reasons we're having this discussion is because we thought our listeners would be interested, because there's so much building going on in Ames, so much student housing going on, and we wanted to just look at the whole question. Now, I believe you used to have property on Wilmoth.
I did.
And you were there during the changeover. Would you like to talk about that, about the change from basically working families to mostly students, I believe, on Wilmoth?
Yes, I know there's a huge building project going on out there right now. I sold the duplex that I used to have on Wilmoth to that building project. We seem to have a goal in increasing the enrollment at Iowa State, and in order to do that, we have to have housing for the students. I felt that it was an important thing for me to be a part of that.
Okay. Now, Susan, you interviewed Kelly Diekman about this situation, and we played that interview earlier. Do you have a thought on this angle?
Well, he mentioned Wilmoth, and just in passing, that was a particular area where they'd had some concerns. And you didn't say very much about your concerns, except you sold because you thought that they needed the heavier density development. But were there any people that you knew on Wilmoth who felt differently?
Oh, yes. There's a neighborhood group involved that still strongly believes that it was not a good thing or is not a good thing.
Did some of them sell as you did, or did some of them just hold on to their property?
No, I sold to Breckenridge.
That's a developer, right?
That's the developer, yes. It's my understanding there were only three properties there on Wilmoth that were sold. The fourth one did not.
And so what's the situation for the fourth one? Are they going to be kind of like an island surrounded?
I believe that's correct, yes.
Yeah, there's a similar situation I noticed. I don't know if it'll stay that way. On Lincoln Way, there's all the properties being sold, and there's these multi-story buildings going up, and there's a little solitary house, a holdout, sitting in the middle of it.
So obviously there isn't eminent domain.
And not at this time, to my knowledge.
Earlier, you mentioned the evolution properties, but personally, how was it to hold on to those properties for such a long time? Did you have any moments when you felt this maybe was a little more than you wanted to handle?
Yes, many times, Susan. this property that I sold on Wilmoth was in my husband's family. It was his grandparents' home where they raised their four daughters. So it was a very difficult decision for me. And yet I realized, too, that we can hold those memories forever, but we don't have to have the physical property in order to do that. And this was an offer that just couldn't be passed up, and so I sold.
But earlier you mentioned some of the difficulties over the years in having all this property to manage and how you felt about your husband getting you into this.
An example. Yeah. I'm working away at my office. He calls me. It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and he says, "Okay, what do you think about this house on whatever the address was?" And I said, "Oh, no, we have enough to take care of. We don't need any more. It's all we can do. I'm working full-time. He's doing other, we have children at home. Well, you better stop at the bank on your way home because I already bought it." And so we'd end up with another one. Right. And that happened, in those kinds of sequences.
And how did it end?
I had a bunch of them, some of which I've sold since then because it was too much. I have a manageable number now. But over the years, I have learned that most things can be repaired. Most things are not of an emergency nature, as sometimes presented. I have some very good, dependable helpers in the business that mean the world to me, and through all of that learning process, we can take on most anything.
Wow. I was a landlord for a very brief time before I sold a house. I sort of had to move closer to, this is when I lived in Massachusetts, I had to move into Boston, and I rented out my house on the South Shore, and I wouldn't want to do it ever again.
There are some very rewarding minutes, though, in the business. I meet a lot of nice young people. I've kept in track with some of them for many years. I've attended weddings and baby showers and all that kind of stuff with them. And in sort of ways, some of them become part of my family. I try and recognize them by name. I talk with them when I see them, and I'm very involved in the business.
Now, one of the complaints people make is when students have parties, they're too noisy. Do you get a lot of complaints like that about noise or disturbance?
No. I give them one chance. If the police are called, I usually arrange for either some moving out procedures or some other measures that take care of the problem.
And they know that in advance?
It's stated in the lease and rules and regulations.
Well, I'd like to go back to something that you mentioned at the very beginning about the regulations. I once also had a rental, and I remember the regulations being demanding and not necessarily easy to follow for older housing. In fact, in my case, it was impossible, but they kept trying to get me to put a driveway, a 75-foot driveway, to get a vehicle behind the house or behind the front of the house, which was in the back of the lot. And I was surprised at, even for a single house, just how many regulations there were, how demanding they were. And I know something like sprinkler systems, you don't have to have sprinkler systems in your apartments, do you?
No, I do not. I believe there are regulations that require them with a certain number in the dwelling. Mine don't happen to meet that number.
But are there any others? What are any other things that have caused you extra expense or difficulty?
Oh, the parking issues. We have to have fire doors. We have to have windows that open and shut, and things have to be vented properly with the plumbing issues. Furnaces and air conditioners and those kinds of things have to be inspected And it just goes on and on and on. And, of course, the other side of that, as a property owner, I want to make sure those things are safe.
Of course, yeah.
I would feel terrible if anything happened mm-hmm. that was my fault in that regard.
Well, you obviously have a very good relationship with your renters and long-term relationship, and you obviously get a lot of pleasure out of this. So,
there are some other times, however. Uh-huh. The phone calls at 1:30 a.m. and that kind of thing.
What, because of emergencies?
One of my renters' mother called at 1:30 a.m. to tell me that there was a light in the hallway out. So that's the kind of thing that makes it hard. But you put it all in
the perspective, yeah.
Big picture, and uh-huh. that's fine.
That was Mary Bookman, a local landlord. And this is Local Talk on KHI Community Radio. I'm Kay Patuk, your host today. Thank you for joining me. Now it's time to hear more news from the City of Ames, because I'm happy to welcome Susan Guiazda, Public Relations Officer for the City, and she's brought a guest with her today. Welcome, Susan.
Good morning. And I brought a guest with me. Donald Kamm is our director of Ames Electric Services. And one of the reasons that I brought Don with us this morning is because we have a really exciting initiative that's going to kick off soon. And we are just starting to spread the word on a community solar project. And I'll let Don talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah.
People have been waiting, and we're very excited to move forward on this.
Yeah, basically, we've had a lot of our customers install their own solar, but there's many customers out there that can't. They can't put it on their own homes. They may be a renter. Maybe their home won't support it, or maybe it's facing the wrong direction. So one of the things that the Ames City Council directed us to do is they said, let's do a community solar project. And this will be a project that would allow anyone and everyone in Ames, an Ames Electric customer, to participate in this project and be part of a bigger solar, we call it a solar farm.
Mm-hmm. And we're lucky that we have another model in the state that we can look at for some direction. We won't be the first person to do it, but I would say that it's still pretty cutting edge at this point to implement a renewable source like this and allow a community to get involved. But we've been looking a lot to Cedar Falls, Iowa.
Uh-huh. Now, I don't know how familiar people are with the site of solar farms. I've seen a big one in Texas. But the one I saw, it didn't look to me as if you could do any kind of farming underneath it the way you can with a wind farm. You know, you can grow crops around the windmills and so on. But with a solar farm, it basically covers the whole ground, doesn't it?
Yes. And a solar farm, basically what you're trying to do is capture, you have as much square footage as you can that captures the sun and then turns that into electricity.
Yeah, and it's really fascinating to drive by them at different times of the day because they align to where the sun is, and they tilt all the time.
Yeah, there are some that move. Uh-huh. The ones that we're looking at, because we're in a northern part of the country, mm-hmm. will probably, what they call it, say, is fixed. They'll be facing south, try to capture as much of the sun as possible. We would try to use land that maybe wouldn't be the best for agricultural or may have other limitations to it. So it's not like... We don't want to take good agricultural land out of production if we can help it. So one of the things that we first started doing was looking at possible sites that maybe would be restricted and allow us to do that. And we think we found a piece of property down near the airport. That's one of the sites that we're looking at right now and making sure that it'll be very good for what we're trying to do. And it's not going to be... probably as big as the one you may have seen in Texas. This is something a little bit smaller. Mm-hmm. But we think that once we get this first project in, this could be a good template. This could be phase one of many phases uh-huh. of solar in Ames for the future.
I'm trying to visualize where in relation to the airport, where this will be.
It would be north of the airport, kind of near where Sam's Club is.
Okay.
There's a little piece of property there. It's
okay.
kind of off of Highway 30.
About how much? Like an acre, 2 acres?
Oh, we're looking at probably 10 acres.
Oh, that much. Okay.
You bet. Uh-huh. Solar takes up a lot of land to capture that much sun. And we're looking at a 2-megawatt. Megawatt is a measure of energy. Mm-hmm. Probably serves, well in excess of a couple of thousand homes. We were trying to describe that to a group of people the other day, and I would say it's about as much energy or peak usage that something like Mary Greeley would use. 2 megawatts is about the size of Mary Greeley in terms of electrical load.
Uh-huh. So how will individual households become a part of this.
Ah.
Yes, so getting others involved, that's the community part of a community solar project. We have named this project SunSmart Ames, and we are looking at cultivating interest in the project and actually getting people to kind of commit. It is difficult because there are a lot of unknowns, and people are hesitant to commit without everything finalized. But we're looking at numbers to join, basically costs to our customers, and then how many customers that we really need to support the venture. And that does seem like a little bit of a moving target, but we're getting closer to having that nailed down, and we really are starting to get out and market this program.
Yep. We're actually working it from two sides. On one side right now, we have what's called a request for proposal out to a lot of the solar developers, people that have this expertise that would come in. They would put the panels in, they would design it, construct it, operate it, so that we're working on that piece of it. The other piece is the community solar involvement, and until we have selected that final developer, some of the costs are, you know, we're working on estimated costs as opposed to final costs, and the way the customers then would participate, they basically financially support the project, and then all of the energy that comes off of the solar farm then would be basically given to anyone and everyone that participated. So you can opt into the project, or you can say, yeah, I don't want to do this project, or I want to wait till a later one. And that's how we get then the community to participate.
Now, the way you put that, you said then the energy will be given to them, and it made it sound as if it sounded too good to be true. Once you've sort of made the investment, you get free energy ever thereafter.
But to a point, that's right. But, I mean, there is an initial investment. You know,
right.
Building a solar farm, it's kind of like a co-op.
Sure,
very much like a co-op. And so once you make that initial investment, then the energy it produces, it'll produce energy for 20-plus years. And then that energy belongs to those Ames Electric customers that participated in the project. And so, yeah, then that energy will be credited or put on the individual customer's bill. The numbers we're looking at probably are going to be under $500 per customer to participate.
So you would buy in and you would buy a percentage of the energy.
Correct.
And then you would...
Well, and then, so you buy into a percentage of the energy.
Say $500, or it could be more.
It'll probably be less, with you.
Well, suppose I've got a huge mega mansion. Or...
Right. You could buy in multiple times. Again, each buy-in, or what we like to call each power pack that you purchased, is only a tiny fraction of your home's use. These are, so you would pay in an initial cost. If you wanted multiple power packs, again, think about that as $500 each time. You would have to buy, we were kind of trying to think about that, maybe 10 power packs to cover your home.
Something,
I see.
Yep.
So if you've got an average, say, a ranch house, say, you know, relatively modest ranch house, how many power packs would you need?
We're thinking maybe about 10.
10 power packs. So 10 times 500.
That could be, or could even be a little bit higher.
That's not too bad, 5,000.
Correct. But you don't even have to cover all of your load.
Yeah, you can just do a percentage of it.
You bet. I'm looking at maybe buying two this time and then waiting for the next project. I'll probably buy a couple more so that I've even diversified my energy portfolio, if you will.
But you've diversified the number of bills you've got to pay.
Well, but to be honest, we're trying to make that as simple as possible.
Right.
You'll have one bill. So all of this will show up on your electric bill.
Okay.
So as you get your normal electric water bill from the city, there will be a credit on there.
How much of your solar was produced that month.
Yeah. What? Oh.
And again, I think what we really want to emphasize is that people who we feel the feedback that we've gotten is people who are most interested in this project, it's not a return on investment that they're looking at. It's more their commitment to being a good steward of the environment. And so for an investment, you might be looking at 20 years to stay in to get your credits, to get your initial investment back. And so, you know, it may be not if you're somebody who likes to dabble in Wall Street, it's probably not the best percentage. But if you're committed to a cleaner environment, this, I think, will really interest people.
Yep. Yes, yes.
It's nice in Ames that we're blessed with very inexpensive energy. Our energy is in that 9-10 cent range, whereas if you're in California or New York and places like that, it's 2 to 3 times that amount of energy. So that blessing is great. But then when you look at solar, solar costs about that much. So trying to say, I'm going to do it and I'm going to save a ton of money, we don't want to give that message out and say that
In the short term it won't, but ultimately in the long term. And ultimately, of course, as Susan was saying, it will save the planet.
The key point. It's not necessarily money, but it's the environment that we want sustained, lasting.
I mean, despoiling the environment has cost of two. In the long run, of course.
And we talked about wind initially, and wind is a great resource, and we do have wind in our portfolio. The problem with wind energy in this part of the country is that wind is the strongest when we don't peak in our energy use. So a lot of those blustery winter evenings, if those windmills or if those turbines are really going fast, it's not necessarily when we need the electricity or a summer peaking utility. And so for solar, that makes a lot of sense for us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Solar is the strongest when the sun is out, when there are no clouds, when it's hot out.
Right.
Solar is when it's strongest. So we would have had good production this past weekend.
Very nice this last weekend.
Yes. Now, what you're saying about the storms and too much energy, in a sense, that brings up the question of storing solar energy or storing wind. Is this...
figure that one out.
Well,
energy storage is, I think, probably the next big breakthrough in the industry, both at the homeowner level and at the customer level or business level. But the utilities are also looking at that. The key with that is that you would need so much storage at a utility level. Today, it's cost prohibitive, but there are companies out there that are.
So at this point, it just doesn't make economic sense to worry about the storage thing.
It's something that we're continuing to look
right.
at. All right. There is value in storage. We actually peak in that 5 to 7 o'clock at night range when the sun is sort of starting to – it's not at its maximum. But to look at investing millions of dollars in storage in the traditional sense of a battery right now is somewhat cost mm-hmm. prohibitive. There's been historically people or I shouldn't say people, but utilities that have looked at storage where they may use wind energy to pump water up a hill, store it up there, and then let that go in terms of, maybe a hydro unit and stuff like that. So you can use wind when it's variable, pump it up, and then let it go when you really need it. And that's another form of storage.
Right.
Not super effective because there's losses and things like that from evaporation and things. But
there are storages. And it can't be applied everywhere.
And you have to probably flood some land, which has other environmental impacts.
I mean, if there's already the kind of environment where you could store.
Absolutely.
In that way, that would make sense. Yeah, and this is no doubt, like everything else in technology, it will evolve. I mean, when you think how computers have changed and got smaller and smaller over the years.
We have had that feedback that there is some concern that if we invest now, the technology will be outdated in the future. We've also had equally enthusiastic feedback saying, start now. You have to start something. Just get something out there.
Yes.
And we've heard a lot from people. We know that there's interest out there. I think they're waiting for us to unveil. And again, it's a work in progress. We are figuring this out. We have a great role model with Cedar Falls. We are looking to how they have handled things and look for more information from the city in the near future. It's coming.
Oh, great. Well, can you say a bit more about your feedback and do you have an idea of how many people are interested at this point?
Oh, man. Everybody I talked to, I was at my dentist the other day, and she said, I want to be the first to sign up for solar. So everybody I've talked to said, I would like to at least get a couple of shares or a couple of
power packs.
Power packs, that's it.
Power packs.
That I can help to support this. And I haven't heard anybody who said, no, this is a dumb idea, don't do it yet. And being a college community, I think there's a lot of forward, progressive thinking people that definitely support this kind of a project.
And we are going to need a fair number of customers to step up and help us to get this going. We do need to get it pretty primarily funded before we get moving. The idea of we have 75% to 80% sold before we actually move forward on it will be a stumbling block for us if we kind of sputter out. again, very enthusiastic response. So we feel cautiously optimistic that this is really going to take off. But we know we've kind of surrounded ourselves recently with people who are really interested in this. And that may not be the average customer. It may be a niche market. And so we're going to work hard to reach out to those people that we know are interested.
Okay. Well, hopefully some of the people listening this morning will be enthused by this. So this is SunSmart Ames, Community Solar Involvement.
And there will be more information available on the City of Ames website /solar. So cityofames.com/.
Dot org.
Did I say that? Oh. Dot org.
Dot org slash solar.
We have a website up there that we'll be updating as it's a very dynamic, exciting, and the information is changing weekly. And we want to get the latest information out there, and that's where you can find it.
Okay.
Great project. If we switch gears for a minute here, I was asked to give a couple of traffic updates. I know we've had a lot of work done on South Duff near the Walmart Supercenter. That has kind of gone on hiatus for a little bit. The medians are up, and the work on South Duff will slow down right now and then go back. They'll come back in July. There is a traffic signal that needs to go up there. And some curb and gutter work, I believe, and some lane work that still needs to happen. So it'll be clear for a while, but then you'll see the workers come back. Also, if you travel South 3rd, South 4th, that street project is progressing on schedule, but it will still be 3 to 4 weeks before they're ready to switch sides. That project is South 3rd, South 4th from Duff all the way west to University. So it's a long stretch, and if you look at it from an aerial perspective, Grand, the intersection of Grand right behind that Hy-Vee is kind of the midway point. Mm-hmm. So from Grand to University has been closed. In a couple of weeks, 3 to 4 weeks, probably sometime early July, it'll switch to the east side, and Grand to Duff will be closed. There will be some travel allowed to access businesses in there, but they'll start working on that part of the street. So those are the big ones. Those are the big projects, and I know that everybody wants to hear about those.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Again, we remind residents, if they want updates on construction projects, to go to our website, cityofames.org.
Got it.
/construction. Construction, and that will get you the latest. There are several smaller projects going around. This is the season for construction, and we know that people are irritated, but we think it is a small-term annoyance for a nice product in the end. And mm-hmm. so there is a really limited time, particularly in Ames, to really get working on these projects. We try not to disturb the university schedule too much, and that really means that when graduation happens in May, that we get moving right away, and when the students start coming back in August, we want to have a lot of these projects buttoned up because a lot of traffic returns. Mm-hmm. It's busy. So some other things right here locally in downtown Ames, beautiful downtown Ames, Tom Evans Plaza was the site of a public piano that was installed.
Right. We were talking about that earlier, actually.
Yeah. And
I haven't actually seen it yet. I've seen pictures.
Yeah, I've seen pictures too, and video. I saw video of it. I was unfortunately out of town this weekend, which was a horrible weekend to be out of town because so much fun things were happening in Ames. And pianos were unveiled both at Tom Evans Park and in Campus Town Court. And those were just part of a project spearheaded by a student from Iowa State who studies the connection of music and brain development.
Right.
And really, really fun. Do you play piano?
No, I don't. I interviewed Patricia Izbicki, though. In fact, it was on this program before you
fabulous.
Came.
Oh, fabulous. Well, I've only talked
with
her.
And she had about 5 minutes of thanking all the people that helped her. That didn't make it onto the air. I just did a general thank you to all the people. But no doubt you are one of them.
Actually, I just learned of the project recently, and I've just been excited by
the city,
it.
Yes.
Right. The Parks and Recreation Department has worked with Patricia and has really – it's really been fun. I'm curious to see – I think those pianos will be well played in the coming months. And at the end of the season, she said they will look at them and decide whether they are to be stored for the season or whether they need to be disassembled and taken elsewhere. But very, very exciting. Just some events for your calendar, switching gears again. The municipal band concerts have started. Last Thursday, June 1st, was the first municipal band concert, and they will continue through July on Thursdays. And this Thursday, June 8th, will be Simon Estes Night at the Band Shell. And we call that City Council Night at the Band Shell. So we will be giving out free cookies and great refreshing Ames water for those attendees that come. You know,
is that Simon Estes himself?
Absolutely.
Yes.
My gosh.
Yes, you'll want to come. I think it's supposed to be a beautiful, beautiful evening. Pre-concerts at 7 p.m. The municipal band plays at 8 p.m. We usually get set up by 6 p.m. because people will come and picnic and have fun. And so join us this Thursday, June 8th at the Band Shell Park for City Council Night at the Band Shell with special guest Simon Estes.
Wow.
Very exciting.
That's certainly something to put on your calendar.
Yeah. Just one last thing. We have the Ames Historic Preservation Commission's hosting a speaker, Steve Wilkie Shapiro, an architect. We'll give a presentation at 7 p.m. on Monday, June 12th in the council chambers. Talk about historic buildings, maintaining the integrity of buildings through renovation, talking about credits, state tax credits and whatnot. If you can't go to the council chambers that night, you can simply watch it on City Channel 12, and we do tend to replay those. So if you miss the actual live video streaming, you can check our archives.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Susan Guiasta. We've just been hearing from Susan Guiasta, Public Relations Officer for the City of Ames, and today she had a guest, Donald Com.
You got it.
Director of Electric Services, hearing about the community solar involvement, Sun Smart Ames. This has been Local Talk on KHY Community Radio, a program where we explore the stories, people, and places of Central Iowa. I've been your host, Kay Partick. Earlier in the show, we heard from local landlord Mary Bookman, and from Kelly Diekman, Director of Planning and Housing for the City of Ames. We also heard about the public outdoor pianos from graduate student Patricia Isbecki, who brought the outdoor piano project to fruition. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here at KHY at 89.1 FM. Also remember that you can hear Local Talk online at khyfm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI is also streaming live online at khyfm.org. Our theme music is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you'd like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. So come and see if you'd like to join the Local Talk team. If you enjoyed this show, please tell your friends and check us out on Facebook. Here at KHOI, we've made a change in our morning schedule. Until recently, Democracy Now! Was aired on KHOI only at 6 p.m. on weekday evenings. We're now airing it also in the morning from 8 till 9 a.m. Morning masterpieces that will return at 9 a.m. We've made this change in order to keep up with the rapidly changing events in national news. We want to provide you with the latest news in the most timely fashion possible. So let us know what you think. You can call us at 515-292-2878, email us at khoiradio@gmail.com, or go to the contact page of our website, khoifm.org. So now stay tuned for Democracy Now! With the headline news at the top of the hour. And please remember that you, as a listener, are the most important part of Local Talk. Your participation as audience and your regular contributions help make it all possible. And now, thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.